Okay, so we had mixtures of unitaries. So rho prime was equal to a sum over L, PL, UL, rho, UL dagger. Or here rho and U are both linear operators on some Hilbert space. Same dimension Hilbert space. PL is just a probability distribution. And we saw a case of the reduced action of a Hilbert of a reduced action, of some U, which was a unitary transformation on 2 degrees of freedom. And we expressed it as a map on just the system A, and we obtained where in general this unitary can entangle these two, or at the very least it can correlate them, if not entangle them. So the final state can't be expressed in this way. And in both cases, we found an effective description of the dynamics on the system Hilbert space alone. That rho prime, and I'll just put an A here to emphasize the Hilbert space A, was given by an object which we called lambda acting on rho, and that was expressed in the form AL rho AL dagger, where the set of operators, well, let me just say it this way, each AL is some linear operator on HA. And they satisfied a constraint, which was that the sum over these operators multiplied by their adjoints, where the adjoint has to be on the left here, that's very important, that they sum to identity on the A Hilbert space. So this gave us a kind of provisional description of the most general transformation that can occur, because these are the only two ways we can kind of think of how to realize this physically in the lab. Okay, I'll just emphasize here, in case two, keep in mind, we assumed rho AB unprimed was equal to rho A tensor rho B. So this is an uncorrelated input state. Uncorrelated input state. This is a critical proviso. Proviso? Tomato, tomato. All right. Okay. Good. So now, should we think about this as the most general thing? And if we do want to think about it as the most general thing that can happen for realistic systems, then can every linear map of this form with this kind of decomposition, which is called an operator sum decomposition, so given some super operator lambda, which takes density operators to density operators, the set of AL satisfying the fact that lambda can be expressed as a sum over L AL rho AL dagger, where actually, I'm going to remove this condition. So this is called an operator sum decomposition. It's analogous to a spectral decomposition. It's a decomposition for expressing the action of this linear map lambda. Yes? Okay, good. I'm going to do Krauss's theorem, so then I'll call them Krauss operators. Yeah, so these are just what you've learned as Krauss operators. So now the question I was getting to you before I want to introduce that definition, the question I'm getting to, is this the most general thing that can happen? So is the map rho goes to rho prime equal to the sum over L, AL, AL dagger, the most general possible transformation taking rho to rho prime? So two provisos again, this is assuming the input state rho is not correlated with anything else. And if we demand that the trace of rho prime is equal to the trace of rho, so normalization is preserved, then we want, that implies this normalization. Okay, so is this the most general thing that can happen? So we can address that question in a moment, but first we're going to introduce the concept of complete positivity. All right, so consider a linear map that takes density operators to density operators. So calling them density operators means I'm saying that they're non-negative operators with trace one. Sorry, let me just fix this. So consider, if for every row in input, okay, so for every input state row, that is non-negative, the output rho prime is also non-negative. Okay, then lambda is called a positive operator. Or that lambda is a positive map. This is a definition of positivity. So clearly, this is a requirement we would expect of a valid quantum transformation. We want the object, the mathematical object that comes out of it, if we make some observation, we want it to give us valid probabilities via Born rule. And it's exactly the set of non-negative operators that give us non-negative numbers for Born rule. And if we impose normalization, then we get non-negative numbers that add to 1, that are bounded between 0 and 1 and add to 1. So I'm not always carrying along this normalization condition, because as we'll see later, let me just give you a forward reference here. We're going to see that measurement itself with post-selection, which we've seen instances of already, it turns out you can think of that as a kind of transformation. And it's going to be a special case of this class of transformations that we're defining here. And it's going to be a case where normalization is not preserved. Okay, so it's going to be a map that preserves non-negativity but not normalization, because when you post-select on an outcome, you're throwing away systems. And normalization is all about, you have some ensemble, we want probabilities to add to 1, and your relative frequency should add to 1. But if you, every time you press the go button in our operational picture, if you get some outcome and then you disregard the system that comes out, then you're losing normalization. So it's interesting for that reason to consider maps that don't necessarily preserve normalization. So before I do this too carefully, did you guys see complete positivity in preparation for this? No? Okay, good. So this is new. All right, good. So complete positivity. Yeah, this is non-trivial, exactly. This is assumes that you're not throwing away systems based on information you get. All right, so complete positivity is the realization that this is inadequate. The positivity constraint is an inadequate criterion for what we want out of a physical transformation. Can anyone think of why, or maybe you've seen why? I'm sure one of you guys has seen this. Come on. You guys act like you've known everything I've told you already, so assume you know this. All right, so then it'll be new for all of you for a change. All right, good. So basically, what happens if we consider a scenario where we have some cis transformation and... this is our system rho A, and this is other system rho B, and we're going to apply lambda to rho A. Actually, let me correct this. Let me write this as rho AB, all right? So now we're putting rho AB into this transformation, and then we're going to do, some measurement over here on the joint system. And we're going to get some output k prime from that process. So how do we write this down mathematically? Well, that means we have the probability of outcome k is equal to the trace of some projector. I'll just write it as a POVM because we've learned that. So now ek is whatever operator represents the action of this on this bigger Hilbert space. So ek is a linear operator on HA tensor HB. And now what we have is this map lambda is acting on system A, but nothing is happening to system B. So this is lambda tensor identity acting on the input state rho AB. Okay, so what this means is we actually want this object, which is going to map rho AB to rho AB prime. So we have, where can I squeeze this in? What we have is rho AB prime is equal to lambda tensor identity acting on rho AB. So think of this as some larger super operator phi. That's phi. So now what we want is we want the output. We want rho AB prime, which we're plugging into our Born rule. We want that to be producing a valid probability here, which means that rho AB prime has to be a non-negative operator. And we'll want it to have trace 1 if we're not throwing anything away. Okay, so we want this to be a non-negative trace 1 operator. So then the question you have to ask is, if lambda is positive, is it always the case that lambda tensor identity is also positive?
And it turns out that's not always true. There are maps that are positive, but when you trivially extend them by adding identity, you get something that's not positive. So because of this subtlety, you need to define the class of maps that are physically possible as the set of completely positive maps. And completely positive map means that not only is the map positive when it acts on system A alone, but it's also positive when you extend it by an arbitrary identity operator acting on some entangled state of the composite system. Okay, so an example of a map is the transpose map. So if I'm just transposing the matrix, right, so that's adjoint without the complex conjugation, it turns out that's a positive map. So if the input map is, if the input state is non-negative in trace one, the output state will be non-negative in trace one. But if you apply the transpose map to one half of an entangled state and do nothing to the other half, the output state is no longer a valid quantum state, a valid density operator. Okay, so that's why we need to worry about complete positivity. So let me write that down formally for you. It's, of course, in the notes. A map lambda taking row to row prime, let me write A here, is called completely positive if lambda tensor the identity superoperator takes, it will, is positive. Let me just call it is a positive operator, is a positive map. So I've defined positive map, and now I'm defining completely positive in terms of positivity of this extended map. Okay, is that notation clear? Good. And then we also say that a completely positive map and which people just say CP map is also trace preserving is called a CPTP map, which you see commonly, if row AB double prime actually, I guess I can more concisely say if lambda is trace preserving. I guess, I'll just say that explicitly. If row, if trace row AB prime is equal to the trace of row AB. Okay. All right, so now that's a very, okay, so we've introduced this class. So let me just recap. We discovered these this operator sum decomposition or so-called Krauss operators, characterize this very general set of scenarios corresponding to realistic transformations on quantum systems. We found that it's a positive. We didn't show that it was positive. Well, anyhow. And then we realized that for the transformation to be physical, it has to be completely positive. And so now we have an important theorem due to Krauss. Yeah, I should have said that. What's the nice way to say that? I don't know how else you could construe it, actually. It's an identity operator, so I've made no, there's no restriction on its dimension, so maybe it's best just to leave it unspecified. Yeah. Now, it turns out if you want to check this, if you want a, you know, a recipe you can follow to check, is my map completely positive? You don't have to go off to infinity to check it. It turns out it's if you can confirm that it's completely positive, where you, the extended Hilbert space is the same size as the original Hilbert space. So if the original Hilbert space is CD, and the extended Hilbert space is CD, so your total Hilbert space is CD squared. If it's completely positive on CD squared, then it's completely positive for any dimension. So it turns out, yeah, it's sufficient to only check a dimension that matches your original dimension. Yeah?
I'm having trouble to see how the transpose example that you did, for example, could break positivity.
It doesn't break positivity. It breaks, I mean, on the bigger Hilbert space. It's positive on the smaller Hilbert space, but it's not positive on the bigger Hilbert space. Okay, that's an excellent question, because it turns out it ends up being a criterion for entanglement. Because notice, this is going to fail specifically if the state is entangled. If we don't have an entangled state, then the transpose map is complete. It's completely positive on input states that aren't entangled. And the failure mode occurs specifically when the input state is entangled, which means that that ends up being a really interesting, one of the few hard criteria for entanglement we have for mixed states. So let me defer the answer to your question until we discuss that in that context, okay? Any other question? Okay, good. So Krauss's theorem is very powerful, and it tells us that any linear map lambda is CP is a CPTP map if and only if it admits an operator sum decomposition. It preserves trace. Okay, so I kind of go back and forth on whether or not I want to define operator sum decomposition to mean it's trace preserving or not. So because I defined it without implying that it's trace preserving, I have to add this caveat. In fact, I guess I should look back at Krauss's original paper, but one could just state this theorem as a linear map is CP if it admits an operator sum decomposition. We forget about the trace preserving altogether. That's probably a cleaner way to do it. So as you can imagine, this is a very powerful result. So this is now why we call the operators AL are called Krauss operators. I presume that's not what Krauss called them. So this theorem actually holds for infinite dimensional Hilbert space, even though I haven't explicitly shown that to you. In which case, I think it holds for bounded operators. And then, okay, that's the main piece there. So now we have this nice characterization of a set of physical transformations, and now the last question we have to answer is any completely positive trace-preserving map on my Hilbert space, or on my density operators in my Hilbert space, can it be realized physically in terms of our ideal axioms? So just like, remember with Nymark's theorem, we said, look, we found this POVM structure. It gives us a way of gives us a Born rule that predicts probabilities. We see that various scenarios give us POVMs. And then the question was, can any POVM be realized physically? And then Nymark's dilation theorem, which we did a day or two ago, said that yes, it always can be. Where you put some ancilla space and you write some unitary, you can dilate that POVM and express it in terms of von Neumann's indirect measurement model. So now we're going to ask the same theorem. These theorems are very similar, but they're just applied to different contexts. The next theorem is the Steinspring dilation theorem, which plays the same role as Neimark's theorem. And it tells us that any completely positive map can be realized from a unitary and acting on a larger Hilbert space. Okay, so I'll say that in words, and then I'll give you a more precise statement. Actually, let me just give you the precise statement. Any CPTP map, lambda, which takes linear operators on HA to linear operators on HA, can be realized via a unitary transformation U, which is a linear operator on HA tensor HB, via the following expression. Where sigma is a density operator for system B. Yes?
Does that sigma depend on rho, or is it fixed?
Sigma will depend on lambda. Right? Right, this map has to be independent. It has to work for any row, and it has to be the same. So we want a process, so that's a good point. We want some representation that works for any row. So for any input row, I want to get the correct row prime out. And so we want to construct this U and the choice of sigma so that it works for any input. Now it's, that said, it might be that the freedom in selecting sigma can be completely transferred into the freedom of selecting U. Can you see why that would be? From our previous results? No, there's no measurement in here. What was the other dilation theorem we saw? The first one. Via Schmidt decomposition. That was a purification. So any density operator can be expressed as a pure state in a larger Hilbert space. So I can always just enlarge HB until any sigma becomes a pure state. And then I can just make this unitary tensor identity if I needed to, because that's still a unitary. And then once I have a pure state, then the only difference between any choice of pure state is some choice of local unitary on system B. So I can just absorb that into the unitary as well. So, okay, I've just convinced myself that we can write this as this is without loss of generality. We can take sigma to be some fixed state 0 on system B. Now, there's also it's good to economize the size of the Hilbert space you're using. So if you're in the lab and you want to actually implement some CP map to achieve some goal, and you're saying, okay, well, this is not a unitary, it's a CP map on my system A. Say my system A is a spin half particle. And I want to implement some arbitrary CP map, CPTP map on that spin half particle for whatever purpose. And you say, okay, well, to do that, I'm just going to use Steinspring's dilation theorem. And I'm going to construct some unitary on a bigger Hilbert space that's going to realize that, and then I'm going to ignore that other ancilla system I brought in, right? I'm just going to trace it out and just throw it in the garbage can and don't look at it. So once if you look at it, that changes what the map is, right? If you do a measurement on that ancilla, then you gain information and you get an update rule rather than a CP map, right? A special case of CP map, I should say. So we're going to discard that system. Then you might say, well, look, controlling extra degrees of freedom in a bigger Hilbert space is hard. It's a technical challenge. So I want to use the smallest extra Hilbert space I need to achieve this goal. So it might, right? So I might say, I just have one other spin half particle available, and I can couple those two. But to bring in a third spin half particle, that's going to be really hard for me because I can't control that third particle very well. It's too far away or on the molecule or something. So what you're going to do is you're going to say, well, look, well, turns out I can realize this if I allow my input state of that first ancilla spin half, if I allow that to be mixed, I might be able to realize the CP map, right? So there are reasons why you might want to use a mixed state here, for reasons. But theoretically, you can always think of it this way. So this is more of a theoretical. Consideration. Because in practice, we might want to use a mixed state to save resources. Okay, and so notice again the key point that the ancilla system is uncorrelated with the system we're transforming. And in fact, if you have a correlated state and you apply this result, the resulting map you'll get will not be completely positive. So remark, if rho tensor sigma goes to some correlated state, such that rho A, which is equal to the trace over B of sum over L PL rho L tensor sigma L. And we'll just define this to be, define that to be rho. So if my reduced state going in is the partial trace of this correlated state, then lambda acting on rho, which is equal to the trace over B of U sum over L PL rho L tensor sigma L U dagger, may not be completely positive. It may not be completely positive, and moreover, it may not even be a linear map. Let me think about that. Yeah. It may not even be a linear map. All right, so initial correlations destroy this kind of happy picture we're trying to build of an effective description of realistic quantum mechanics. We're not going to be able to describe a transformation where the initial state is correlated with this completely positive formalism. Even though you will commonly hear from people in the field that that's the full story, it's not the full story. We have these nonlinearities that can arise in special circumstances that actually have been confirmed experimentally. Okay, so if you're interested in this topic, which, I mean, this is an interesting topic for those of you who are interested in quantum information, for example, or just quantum mechanics formulation, just the theoretical formulation of quantum mechanics. Dealing with this problem, coming up with an effective description of the dynamics when you have initial correlations, is a major open problem that people are actively looking at right now. How to mathematically characterize this set? So it's a topic of current interest. It's a very hard problem. There may be no simple framework that accommodates all cases, but it's something people are tackling. So if you're interested in this, I have an example in the lecture notes where I show how this arises via two successive, what are called CNOT maps. So you can have a look at that at your own leisure. Okay. It's not hard. I don't have an example in front of me, and I've learned the hard way. It's not always good to try and, you know, solve some problem in front of you guys. There's a straightforward procedure you can follow to construct the unitary. You know, actually, maybe this would be a good homework problem if you have room for it. I give this as an exercise to students that when I teach this course at Quant. I mean, there it's a full semester course, and then we go into that. Basically, remember, you have to start out with some specification of the problem. So I can't just use hand gestures to tell you what lambda is. I have to give you something. And so what I'm going to give you is a set of Krauss operators. So that's your starting point. So then from the Krauss operators, which have some matrix representation, you're going to find a dilation, which is going to express those as unitaries on a bigger space. So your input is the Krauss operators, and then you can actually deduce. There's no guesswork involved. You can deduce a set. And in fact, these are it's an underdetermined problem, so there's more than one solution. Yes?
In the sum, what are the different rows, like row L and sigma L?
Here? Yeah. This is just some arbitrary selection of...
What I'm saying here is I'm saying, look, this first row, let's let L start at 1, okay? So then row 1 is, you know, the spin up, and sigma 1 is the second spin along the x-axis, x up. And then row 2 might be spin y, spin minus y, and sigma 2 might be spin z down. All right, so it's just a set of density operators, and I'm adding those probabilistically. So there's a correlation, meaning that, you know, whenever I have rho is spin up, then sigma is spin right, or whatever I said. So it's a correlated preparation. So that's all I'm just saying. There's some mixture of preparations which have a correlation between them. Okay, so what I want to do today still is I want to just give you some simple examples of quantum channels. And then what I'm going to do is do a little bit of mathematics for you. So a lot of the respondents on the survey said they would like to see more math. So I've been advised not to do too much math, but because there's a popular demand for it, I will tell you a little bit about the structure of linear operators and how it all fits, like trace class operators, Hilbert-Schmidt operators, and some really neat mathematical structure involved in describing these completely positive maps. All right, so first we'll do the examples, which is more physical, and then we'll do the math. And then my big goal is tomorrow, I want to get you a new version of the notes by tonight. So I don't know how quickly we can get a turnover where you guys can get those in hand. Because I imagine that it's easier if you have the notes in hand so you can follow the lecture and not be writing frantically. So I wanted to do some theory of measurement stuff tomorrow, which is usually a fun thing because it brings out everyone's different point of view on the matter. And that's a nice thing to do on a Friday. Today is Thursday, right? What day is today? Thursday? Yeah, good. Okay, tomorrow is Friday. Good. I want to make sure you have your notes in front of you so we can focus on the discussion And I imagine you'll have lots of questions. Aggie's been suggesting to, as much as possible, kind of promote discussion about the material rather than just talk at you. So we'll try and develop that model a bit tomorrow. Okay, good. So now some simple examples of completely positive maps. So probably the most basic example is called the depolarizing channel. So here, this is a map. I'll just put a subscript to tell which map we're talking about. It's going to take as input any state rho on some, so rho isn't in a Hilbert space, it acts on the Hilbert space. So some preparation rho for that Hilbert space. And it's going to spit out, how do I do my probabilities here? It's going to spit out the identity state, the completely mixed state, where you lose all information about the system with some probability p. And with some probability 1 minus p, it's going to give you exactly the input state back. All right. So what that means is with some probability, it does nothing. And with another probability, it destroys your state. You have no information about it. OK, so what are the Krauss operators for this map? So here, so p is a probability. Probability. So what are the Krauss operators? OK, we're going to use an identity. So we use the identity that the trace of rho times the identity operator is equal to 1 over d squared, sum over, we call it a, b, from 1 to d, of PAB rho P dagger AB. Okay, what are these objects here? These are the Heisenberg-Weil operators, which are the generalized Pauli operators. So let me tell you what those are. So PAB is equal to x to the a, z to the b, where here we're dealing with a d-dimensional Hilbert space, obviously. Well, not well, hopefully obviously. And then the action of x is to take any state j and raise it by 1. And the action of z is to take any state j and add a phase, where that phase is the dth root of unity. So the phase is going to be I 2 pi j over d. OK, so be careful here. So here, this I is the imaginary number I. And this j is just an index. OK, so here we have j goes from 0 to d minus 1. And I is equal to the square root of minus 1. OK, so you can see how these are the familiar Pauli operators, right? So if we have a two-dimensional Hilbert space, then this is sigma x, and this is sigma z, right? Because we're going to get I pi 0, which is e to the 0, which is 1. Or we're going to get I pi 1, which is e to the I pi, which is minus 1. Yeah. So maybe more precise here. So this is mod d. So if j equals d minus 1 and we add 1, then we get d, which is 0 again. These are called the Heisenberg
this.
Okay. Oh, thank you. Right. Well, so A and B, I think it's written over there. Oh, I have these guys going from 1 to D. Oh, they're just scalars. They're just these indices. This is x to the power a, so this is just x squared or x cubed or x to the fourth. Yeah, this is the power. Yeah, sorry. It's good. Thank you. I mean, you guys got to bring out these kind of implicit assumptions of mine so that we're all on the same page. Well, it should. Better. Well, let's check it. All right, let's do that. Because, okay, so sigma x is equal to 0, 1, 1, 0. So the action of 0, 1, 1, 0 on the state 1, 0 is obviously to do 0, 1. And the action of x on the state 0, so this is 0, is going to be to make it 1. So here we have the code 0 is represented as 1, 0, and 1 is represented as 0, 1. And then likewise, x acting on 1 is going to be equal to 0 mod d mod 2. And we can check that 0, 1, 1, 0 acting on 0, 1 is equal to 1, 0. All right? I've dropped the square root of 2 normalization. Maybe that's what's bugging you. Okay. Okay, good. Okay, just regular confusion. Okay, good. Not confusion due to my notation. That's always nice. All right. Okay, so now this is good to know for a lot of reasons, but now we're just using this for this kind of simple goal of finding the Krauss operators for the depolarizing channel. So substituting that identity, we get lambda depolarizing rho is equal to 1 minus p plus p squared, plus p over d squared times rho plus p over d squared times sum over ab. Did I start my index at 1 or at 0 here? Where is it?
1.
All right. So then we're going to have this go from 2 to d. Oh, shoot. All right, so I have to change this. This has to start at 0, sorry. This has to start at 0 and go to d minus 1 because of how I've defined the Pauli operators. So now this is going to start at, this is going to be not equal to 0, 0. So let me just make this clear here. This is identity rho identity, where the point is that p 0, 0 is equal to identity. So this is p 0, 0 rho p 0, 0. And then we sum over all terms except the term where both a and b are 0, 0, which we already have. Yeah, you can have 1, 0. Anything that does, because then you get just a z or just an x, which is a non-identity action. Okay, let me put hats everywhere so you guys can keep track of what's an operator. Yeah, right. So now you can just read off the Krauss operators. We'll just define a Krauss operator AB as... make sure I don't make any typos here, as square root of p over d pab This is for AB not equal to 0, 0. And in the special case of 0, 0, we have a different normalization, which is 1 minus p plus p over d squared, all square rooted, times the identity operator, which is p 0, 0. Let me just call it p 0, 0. Okay, so now we've defined the depolarizing channel, which is a completely positive map. We've found its Krauss operators. And then you can just check that sum over AB of AB dagger AB is going to be equal to identity. On the left, there's a question.
In the third to last line on the blackboard, is the dagger missing on one of the pieces?
The right.
Where?
The third to last line on this blackboard.
And 33?
Yeah, dagger on one of the pieces.
On the right.
There's a dagger missing.
Ah, yeah. Thank you.
And then another question. Didn't we want the same number of Krauss operators as the dimensions of the Hilbert space?
That's a tricky question. So want, let me answer the question this way. It's unconstrained. So there are maps which require only two Krauss operators to describe their action. Remember the very first example we looked at, where we looked at a probabilistic combination of unitaries. So if the physical map I'm implementing is some map where with probability a third, I do sigma x transformation to the system, which is a unitary, and with probability two-thirds, I do sigma z transformation, which is a rotation about z-axis. Then I rate that as a Krauss operator sum, I get two terms, the one that's proportional to x and the one that's proportional to z. So you can have less than d squared, I'm sorry. You can also have more than d squared. But it turns out, but now here's, I think, what you really want to know, which is if I just give you some arbitrary map lambda, and I say find me a Krauss operator decomposition, you can always find one which has at most d squared terms. So d squared is the most you actually need. So any one that has more than d squared terms, you can compress it and find another operator sum with only d squared terms. Okay? Yes?
This map that we have to lambda is only defined for operators like density matrices, but this one is free. I mean, the representation that we are having is linear, but the original map in general operators is not.
What do you mean by the original map?
The one we have written there with p identity over b. That's 1 minus p squared. That map's not linear.
This is linear?
Yes, sir.
Better be. So what linear means is we have a convex combination.
Ah.
Right. So we know physically it has to be convex linear.
Your presentation will hold it, I guess, because it's linear. R would be the trace that we are using in that other identity. If we have that trace there, which is 1.
Hold on a second. So first of all, I'm defining this to be a completely positive map, which is by assumption a linear map. And that I think the fact that it's a linear map that's positive guarantees that it's convex linear, which means it's an affine map. So I see it as that way. We've assumed it's linear. And we know if it's linear, that trivially implies that it's affine. So can you repeat your question in that context?
No, I was just wondering, where was it? So the definition of the, we are representing our map, that representation only holds if we're considering input matrices of trace one.
So I trace one. That's a normalization question. I guess I'm not catching. One that's not a density operator. Yeah, okay, if you break the assumption that you're acting on density operators, then I guess lots of things can probably go wrong. I'd have to think through what the specific case you're worried about is, though. But it's not, I mean, it's also not that interesting, right? Like, okay, maybe, can we talk about this after class? Because I think I'm not quite catching exactly what you're getting at. Okay, good. Yes?
Here?
Yeah.
Because we want...
Okay, so that makes it a state, right? A quantum state. Because we want, for any row, we want trace row equal... Sorry, it makes it a normalized state, to be more precise. Trace row equals 1. The trace of the identity operator on a d-dimensional Hilbert space is d. So we need to divide by d so that it gives us a state. So in other words, you know, the physical interpretation of this is that with probability p, we get the density matrix associated with the identity state, not just the identity operator. Oh, yeah, well, let's see. So how do we use it? Right. So I think you just insert it here. So this identity here, we substitute this expression. And then we collect terms. Good? Okay, so the depolarizing channel. No, I just realized I just have 10 minutes. Okay, the mathematical stuff we'll have to wait till next class because we're not gonna have time today. But let me give you some more interesting examples of completely positive maps. So how many of you have heard about a T1 process? Nobody. Okay. How many of you have heard about spontaneous emission? Everyone. Great. Okay. So how do we get spontaneous emission in quantum mechanics? So if I write down okay, so I have some energy level diagram. This is some excited state. This is some ground state. My electron is going to pop down here, and it's going to emit a photon. All right, so I write down my Hamiltonian for this system, and I get omega. I can just use the sigma z operator. Well, let's not do that. That'll probably be confusing. Let me call it... Excited minus ground. Okay, you can just think of this as sigma z. Okay, so omega represents the energy gap between the two. So omega will be connected to nu, the amount of energy that's released when the electron decays. So this can be any two levels of any system we're interested in. So we can just model it by a two-level operator, sigma z. So what's missing from this picture? Because we know that if we have a Hamiltonian evolution and our initial state at time t equals 0 is the excited state, and I evolve by postulate 3, I evolve under a unitary. Okay, where h over h bar is equal to, I should make this h bar, I guess. Okay, my h bars are 1, so I don't have to keep track of them. H is this, okay? So what that means is that because the initial state, this is supposed to be an E, by the way. This is excited state. The initial state, E, is an eigenstate of h. So it's an eigenstate of u. So that means that u acting on EE U dagger is just going to give me EE. So I start in the energy excited state, in the excited state of energy, and I stay in the excited state of energy under the unitary. So what's missing from this picture to give us spontaneous emission? Okay, too many people answered correctly at the same time. So basically, it's we're missing a coupling term between the atom and the vacuum, or the electromagnetic field, which, say, starts out in vacuum, because I'm assuming I have no photons initially. So I have a coupling, which you can model by, say, the dipole approximation, between this two-level system and the field. And that corresponds to a Hilbert, our Hilbert space is actually Hilbert space of the two-level system, cross product, tensor producted with the Hilbert space of the electromagnetic field, quantized electromagnetic field, which means that, sorry, this is a Hilbert space, which means that H goes to H plus some interaction term, which this interaction term is what couples these two. And then now, when we want to describe just the atom, what are we going to do? We're going to trace out the electromagnetic field. So to describe the atom, to describe the dynamics of the atom, we trace out the electromagnetic field. Okay, so what this means is we have now some initial state rho, which is a density operator for H of the two-level system. Sorry, this isn't in the notes. So this is just a little motivation. Okay, so our initial state is actually an initial state. Well, I should call it AB. Okay, I just want to start calling this A and this B so I can save myself some writing. Okay, and then the unitary is now a linear operator on HA tensor HB, where I've implicitly defined A and B here. And then we're interested in an effective description of spontaneous emission. So we're interested in modeling this as rho A at some time T is going to be equal to the trace over system B of U of T. Rho AB at time zero, U of T dagger. So this is exactly the formulation we just learned. We're taking a partial trace of a unitary acting on a system. But now, what was the key assumption we needed to get our nice formalism? We need to assume that rho AB at time zero is uncorrelated, so the state of the electromagnetic field is not correlated with the initial state of the atom. So when would that assumption break down? If I put the atom in a cavity, I don't know if you guys know how this works. So you put an atom in a cavity, the point is that the atom decays preferentially into the mode of the cavity, and then the cavity keeps that photon bouncing back and forth between mirrors. So now the atom is coupled to the electromagnetic field inside the cavity. But now suppose we have a three-level system where you start out here, the atom decays to here, releases a photon into the cavity. And now we're going to say, okay, now let's forget about that and say we're just starting at the point where the atom is in this intermediate excited state. And the cavity is in some initial state. Well, if I haven't paid attention to what was happening before I started the experiment, my system could be in some kind of superposition of the electron being here or here and the cavity having or not having a photon in the mode, which means that we don't have an uncorrelated initial state. So we can't describe that partial picture with a completely positive map. But if we assume, on the other hand, that the initial state of the atom and the initial state of the cavity are uncorrelated, then we recover this nice formalism, and we're going to get lambda acting on rho A alone as a description, where this lambda is a CPTP map. So now you can ask, what is a simple model of this complex physics? Okay, typically this interaction term is highly non-trivial because you have a fully quantized electromagnetic field, and people typically approximate this via what's called the dipole approximation and use a rotating wave approximation to get a simple model. And then what that's going to do is give us a simple, completely positive map describing spontaneous emission. And now that's the map I'm going to show you, which is called amplitude damping. Okay, so what does that look like? We have our Hilbert space is just the two levels we're interested in modeling the emission for. And we're going to take the first Krauss operator to be 1, 0, 0, 1 minus some parameter gamma, and the second operator to be 0, square root of gamma, 0, 0. And then we can look at what happens to some state under the action of this map. So here, lambda acting on rho is equal to a0 rho a0 dagger plus a1 rho a1 dagger. And so let's just take rho to be equal to rho 0, 0, rho 0, 1, rho 1, 0, rho 1, 1 is a matrix representation in the basis of the two states. So here we have obviously rho 0, 0 plus rho 1, 1 is equal to 1 by normalization. And because it's Hermitian, we have that rho 0, 1 is equal to complex conjugate of rho 1, 0. So this shouldn't be equality. This should be a representation. Be careful. So this is the matrix representation of the abstract operator. And then what you get is that rho prime is then represented as rho 0, 0, 1 minus gamma rho 1, 0, 1 minus gamma. Sorry, I have a little typo here. This is rho 0, 0 plus gamma rho 1, 1. So then the point is gamma is between 1 and 0, where as gamma goes to 1, which way does this work? As gamma goes to 1, it drives the population to 0. So if the initial state, if we start out that rho at time 0 is equal to the excited state, which maps onto what we're calling the 1 state, okay, that means that rho 0, 0 is equal to 0 and rho 1, 1 is equal to 1. Then we see that gamma is going to drive the population away from the excited state into the ground state. And then the time scale of the spontaneous emission is what correlates, is what determines the magnitude of gamma. So if the excited state has a short lifetime, then gamma is going to be big. And if the excited state has a long lifetime, then gamma is going to be small. And we can describe the exponential relaxation of that by taking a continuous limit of this map, which I also do in the notes, although not in the sections you guys have. So you can take a continuous limit and you get an exponential process, which is the Markovian relaxation of an excited state. via this very simple picture. So you can see already the power of these maps is that we have very, very simple ways to describe these very complex physical processes. And can kind of build up intuition and so on about what's going on because of this generalized, realistic picture of dynamics. Any questions about this?
Yes.
Why did you write A0 and A1 in the form that you did over there?
Because
that's what the model is. I mean, this is the model that gives rise to a mechanism that's going to map a population in the excited state down to, I mean, maybe what you're asking is you want me to derive these. Like, I pulled this out of the hat. Is that what's bothering you?
Well, I just was wondering why they're written that way, if there's any reason.
I think the best answer to that question is to actually derive these from first principles, which is extremely non-trivial. So I mean, that's the whole Born-Markov approximation. You start with a system bath. Actually, that's something we could do if you guys are interested in seeing that. It's actually quite involved, but we could do it at a high enough level that you just see the major physical and mathematical assumptions that go into taking an arbitrary system bath coupling and creating this effective exponential relaxation process out of it. So the reason why you would do that is because we know from experiments in NMR and in atomic optics that you often find you can describe these extremely complex processes via what's called a Markovian or a Lindblad picture for exponential relaxation. And so one wants to understand the kind of general conditions that have to be imposed so that that effective model, which works well in a variety of situations, you know, arises from the first principles. And I think the reason why people saw exponential relaxation for so long, for like six decades until recently, is because they couldn't control individual systems with high enough precision to see deviations from that model. So in modern experiments in NMR, modern experiments with superconducting circuits, modern experiments with trapped ions, you find that the noise is not well modeled by these simple pictures because you're violating the Markovian approximation, and now they have enough control and precision to actually see these non-Markovian effects, and that's where things get really interesting and really complicated. I'm happy to kind of adapt the material. So anything to do with open quantum systems, I know a lot about that. So if you want me to discuss anything along those lines, it'd be very easy for me to organize lectures on that with the last half of the course. Also, quantum foundation stuff, I can expound at length on that if you're interested. So please do send me emails if you have some preference about how to adapt. I usually have some flexibility for one or two lectures, and so I can easily accommodate kind of the majority interest of the course. For now, the plan is we're going to talk, we'll do a little bit of mathematics next class on the structure of linear operators, and then we'll talk about the theory of measurement, which is all these issues about a state update. We won't get into the foundational issues of collapse and what that means. We're going to leave that aside and come back to it later. And then I want to talk about entanglement and decoherence a little bit more. And then I want to do maybe a lecture on some concepts in quantum information, and then a lecture on concepts in quantum foundations, which can include the measurement process and other things. I wanted to do also a lecture on Bell's theorem and non-locality, what the story is there. I want even you guys that go into string theory should know that, because I'm tired of talking to string theorists who say things that are wrong about it. So I'm going to start with the next generation and work my way up from there. So we'll make sure we get that straight. And there's probably still room for one or two classes after that. OK, good. Thanks for your great questions today.